content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. Today's show is sponsored by White Memorial Presbyterian Church, to whom thanks. They can be reached at 919-834-3424. From The Economist, first of August 17th, Sharia and civil weddings. How should the law deal with religious marriages? A court recognizes an Islamic union, but insists it is not setting a precedent. How should the state respond when the law of the land points in one direction and social reality, as experienced by a segment of society, in quite another? That dilemma is especially sharp for anybody involved in adjudicating questions of marriage and divorce among Muslims in Britain. A clear majority of the British Muslim couples who settle down together today opt for a religious ceremony known as a nikah, but choose not to complement it with a civil ceremony. This can place a Muslim woman in the worst of all worlds in the event of a marital breakdown. Her marriage has no obvious standing in law, so there is nothing to dissolve and no chance to claim joint assets. In Islamic law, meanwhile, the unilateral dissolution of a religious marriage is a male prerogative. So the female partner in such a failed marriage may find herself chained to her husband from an Islamic viewpoint and also financially disadvantaged. But the situation shifted on July 31st with a high court ruling that offered a chink of light to women in such circumstances. The case concerned Nazreen Akhtar, a lawyer herself, and her estranged partner, Mohammed Shabazz Khan, both now 46. The couple were married by an imam in a London restaurant in 1998. She had tried to persuade her husband to contract a civil marriage as well, but he was reluctant. In a careful ruling, the judge opined that their marriage was procedurally defective but could not be described as non-existent. For nearly two decades, the pair had been treated by their extended families, by their community, and even by the state in some contexts as a married couple. They had received documentation allowing them to live as a married couple in Dubai. The judge also found it significant that Ms. Akhtar had repeatedly proposed a civil ceremony. In every sense, save for the issue of legal validity, this was a marriage, the judge ruled. It therefore followed that the marriage could be declared void, clearing the way for her to claim a share of the couple's assets. The court stressed that this did not automatically recognize all Islamic-only marriages. Each case would have to be judged on its own merits. Yet, this week, secularist campaigners complained about the fact that, in their view, British officialdom gives inappropriate standing to religious marriages. Though they welcomed the verdict, they argue that more fundamental reform is needed, arguing that, quote, the application form for a divorce actively encourages women to turn to religious bodies. The form warns people that civil proceedings may not dissolve the religious part of your marriage, and it is important that you contact the relevant religious authority if you are unsure. To campaigners, this sounds very much like an invitation to consult the informal Sharia tribunals, dozens of which have sprung up in Britain, to adjudicate the affairs of Muslim women whose marriages have failed. In an open letter, campaigners write that our research shows that the power and control of Muslim fundamentalist networks has grown enormously over the last 30 years. This has led to a widespread belief that a civil marriage is not necessary, that women must have a divorce certificate issued by a Sharia court in apparent judicial procedure, and that they must get this certificate even if they already have a civil divorce. If the government is serious about gender equality and ending violence against women, why is it undermining the validity of a civil divorce under English law? Why is it pushing women toward religious courts? There is one simple answer to that rhetorical question. Women turn to Sharia tribunals because the present situation leaves them with little choice. But if it were made compulsory to have a civil procedure in addition to any religious nuptials, then women would always be able to turn to the secular courts to obtain a decent settlement in the event of a marital breakdown. That would become the norm and not the exception. And from the Religion News Service now, of August 25th, hours before the arrival of Pope Francis, the world's leading champion of the environment, the Irish Catholic Bishops' Conference announced it would divest from fossil fuels. The move comes in response to Francis's 2015 environmental encyclical, Laudato Si, or On Care of Our Common Home, and follows the introduction of a bill in the Irish Parliament requiring the country's sovereign wealth fund to divest from all fossil fuels. The bishop's move means withdrawing investments in 200 oil and gas companies within 5 years, said Bishop William Crane, chairman of the Irish Catholic Humanitarian Agency, Trochaer. The Irish Bishops' Conference joins 95 other Catholic organizations worldwide in committing to divestment. If the Irish bill passes, it will make Ireland the world's first government to divest from fossil fuels. The impact in terms of human suffering to families is devastating, said the Irish bishops in a statement Friday, August 24th. Climate change is already leading to forced migration, separation of families, and increased pressure on resources. On June 9th, Pope Francis met with oil executives at the Vatican. Civilization requires energy, but energy must not destroy civilization, he said in his address. Building a more sustainable approach to the economy, work, and the environment is one of six major themes at the World Meeting of Families in Dublin this week. At a panel on Care of Our Common Home, Why the Family Matters to the Future of Our Planet, and at an interfaith service at Dublin's Christchurch Cathedral, bishops from Myanmar and New Zealand addressed the topic of climate change. Cardinal Charles Bwang Mo, Archbishop of Yangon, Myanmar, noted that 3 decades of international debate and negotiation over environmental degradation are, quote, already exacerbating hunger, water shortages in the poorest parts of the world, and affecting profoundly and unjustly those who have done least to cause the problem and who have least resources to cope. Bo said, "We often fail to see that decisions we make in one arena of life, what we consume, how much we consume, what transport we use, how we dispose of things, have an impact on everything else. A true ecological approach always becomes a social approach," he said. Juan Carlos Mendoza, managing director of the United Nations Convention to Compact Desertification, said tackling climate change is not something that is going to be done by politicians or leaders. "It's going to be done by people, including the communities of faith," he told RNS. "They play a very critical role in their families, in their parishes, as citizens." The Great Green Wall Initiative, which seeks to combat the impacts of climate change in all the countries in the Sahara, is one example, he said. "We have seen local communities of different religions coming together around this," Mendoza said. "Muslims and Christians who live in close proximity are working together toward land rehabilitation." Cardinal John Dew, Archbishop of Wellington, New Zealand, also spoke at the gathering. "The world is gifted to us for our good, for our use, but not for our domination. This means protecting it for those who will come after us," he said. "We've come to see ourselves as lords and masters, people who are entitled to plunder it at will. The Pope asks us to lament for the harm we have done and to repent." Pope Francis declared, this is from, the Associated Press of August 25th, "As the Pope arrived in Ireland, he said that he shares the outrage of rank-and-file Catholics over the cover-up of the, quote, repugnant crimes of priests who raped and molested children, and vowed that he was committed to ending the scourge. Seeking to respond to a global outcry over sex abuse by priests, Francis cited measures taken by his predecessor, Pope Benedict XVI, to respond to the crisis. But Benedict never acknowledged the Vatican's role in fueling a culture of cover-up, and Francis provided no new details of any measures he would take to sanction bishops who failed to protect their flocks from predator priests. The failure of ecclesial authorities, bishops, religious superiors, priests, and others, to adequately address these repugnant crimes has rightly given rise to outrage and remains a source of pain and shame for the Catholic community. I myself share these sentiments, the Pope said Saturday in a speech to government officials and civil authorities at Dublin Castle. Francis said he was committed to ridding the Church of this scourge, no matter the moral cost or amount of suffering. Francis's trip to Ireland, the first by a pope in 39 years, has been overshadowed by renewed outrage over the Catholic Church's systemic failures to protect children following revelations of sexual misconduct and cover-up in the U.S. church hierarchy, a growing crisis in Chile, and the prosecutions of top clerics in Australia and France. Francis was expected to meet with abuse victims during his 36-hour visit to Ireland, but neither his words at the start of his visit nor a new meeting with victims is likely to assuage demands for heads to roll over the sex abuse scandal. Disappointing, nothing new, was the reaction from Irish abuse survivor Marie Collins, a former member of Francis's sex abuse advisory panel who quit last year in frustration. Perhaps in an indication of similar sentiments, the reception Francis received in Dublin contrasted sharply with the raucous rock star welcome that greeted St. John Paul II in 1979. No one from the public was at the airports or the roads nearby, though by late afternoon crowds started to grow outside Dublin's cathedral, basking in gloriously sunny weekend weather. Deeply Catholic Ireland has had one of the world's worst records of clergy sex abuse, crimes that were revealed to its 4.8 million people over the past decade by a series of government-mandated inquiries. The reviews concluded that thousands of children were raped and molested by priests or physically abused in church-run schools, and bishops worked for years to hide these crimes. After the Irish Church atoned for its past and enacted tough new norms to fight abuse, it had been looking to the first visit by a pope in 40 years to show a different, more caring church that understands the problems of ordinary Catholic families. More than 37,000 people, most of them young Catholics, signed up to attend a Vatican-sponsored World Meeting of Families that ends Sunday in Dublin, more than twice the number as a previous family rally in Philadelphia 3 years ago. And many faithful did remain hopeful that Francis's appearance would bring healing. I see a lot of new life amongst young people who have a deep, committed faith, Catholic faith, said Sean Escog, a churchgoer in Blessington, southwest of Dublin. Obviously, they are very disappointed by what has happened in the church over the last few years, particularly the whole abuse scandals, but I think people can see beyond that. Francis urged the Irish to do just that, to recognize that for all its failings, the Catholic Church has educated and cared for generations of Irish children in times of famine and great poverty when no one else would. The Church in Ireland, past and present, has played a role in the welfare of children that cannot be obscured, the Pope said. It is my hope that the gravity of the abuse scandals, which have cast light on the failings of so many, will serve to emphasize the importance of the protection of minors and vulnerable adults on the part of society as a whole. Irish Prime Minister Leo Varadkar concurred, saying the Church stepped in to care for Irish children when the state did not. But in his speech to the Pope at Dublin Castle, he said both church and state had a history of sorrow and shame, and he urged the Pope to ensure that victims of sex abuse find justice and truth and healing. Varadkar cited the recent Pennsylvania grand jury report, which found 300 priests had abused more than 1,000 children over 70 years in six dioceses, in urging Francis to ensure that from words flow actions. In recent weeks, we have all listened to heartbreaking stories from Pennsylvania of brutal crimes perpetrated by people within the Catholic Church and then obscured to protect the institution at the expense of innocent victims, Margaret Carr said. It's a story all too tragically familiar here in Ireland. Indeed, Ireland's tortured history of abuse has left its mark. In a country where Catholic bishops held such sway that they advised the drafters of the Republic's constitution in the 1930s, voters in recent years have turned their backs on core Catholic teachings. They have overturned a constitutional ban on abortion and legalized divorce, contraception, previously banned homosexual acts, and same-sex marriage. Irish abuse victims and their supporters were to hold a solidarity rally Sunday in Dublin at the same time Francis is celebrating his final mass to close out the rally. Separately, survivors of Ireland's wretched mother and baby homes, where children were exiled for shame at having been born to unwed mothers, are holding their own demonstration Sunday. The location is Tuam, a site of a mass grave of hundreds of babies who died over the years at a church-run home. Francis will be nearby, visiting the Marian Shrine at Knock, but has no plans to visit the gravesite. In his inaugural speech, Francis referred euphemistically to the plight of Irish women who were forced for generations to work in laundries or other workhouses because they got pregnant outside of marriage. But he said only that they and their children, who were sent to orphanages, endured particularly difficult situations. When John Paul visited Ireland in 1979, in the first ever papal visit, some 1.25 million people turned out for his inaugural mass in Phoenix Park, a third of the country's population, and the largest gathering in Irish history at the time. About half as many are expected Sunday for Francis. And back to The Economist now of August 16th. Christianity and the abuse scandal. A Christian responds to revelations of clerical abuse. Ron Dreher favors introversion inspired by a spirit of repentance. Ron Dreher is one of America's most influential religious commentators. He has made the case that in today's godless West, the only viable strategy for traditionally minded followers of Jesus Christ is to make a partial withdrawal from society and abandon the struggle to assert political power. It is a case he lays out in his book, The Benedict Option, a strategy for Christians in a post-Christian nation. Although he finds much to admire in Benedict XVI, the Pope Emeritus, the title of his book came from Saint Benedict, the church father of the 6th century, who laid the foundations of monasticism in the Western world. Mr. Dreher is not suggesting that today's Christians, apart from a small minority, will literally become monks, but he thinks that Christians' best hope of survival lies in a self-conscious retreat into disciplined, prayerful, and perhaps relatively small communities. The writer's view has been undented by the election of an American president who, though not very pious himself, relied heavily on the votes of evangelical Christians, or by the advent of a vice president and secretary of state who are strident advocates of conservative Christianity. The stronger trend, he believes, is toward the emergence of a society where people with traditional ideas, about gender and sexuality in particular, have no place in the public square. What does a thinker of this rigorously pessimistic persuasion make of the clerical sex abuse scandals that plumbed new depths this week? A grand juror's report found that at least 1,000 and probably far more children were abused, perhaps sometimes in horrible ways, by priests in Pennsylvania over many decades. These misdeeds were systematically covered up by their superiors. Mr. Dreher answers that question in a column in the New York Times, which is commendably frank in facing up to some agonizing truths. Quote, "The crisis is systemic and will not be resolved by new policies and procedures, as the hapless Episcopal bureaucrats want to think. Pope Francis is not going to swoop in to save the Catholic Church. If the Church is to be rescued, it will have to happen in the everyday lives of the faithful, no longer deceived by illusions or false promises of faithless shepherds." In other words, the church's newly exposed pathologies provide yet another reason for a kind of pious retreat into smaller communities where a spirit of self-discipline and self-examination would prevail. And with decent honesty, he acknowledges that the biggest challenge to Christianity's future may not come from the decadence and hostility of a secular world, but from things that have happened inside its walls. The greatest threat is from internal weakness and vice. Many readers, including those who are far from his world of traditional faith, will find more to like in Mr. Dreher's newly contrite tone than they did in his earlier advocacy of withdrawal from a wickedly secular public arena. The ideal of pious retreat will always be fraught with contradictions. It is a historical fact that monastic and other self-isolated communities have always had their fair share of human weaknesses, from ruthless power struggles to manipulative relationships. That applies as much to modern spiritual communities, from New Age communes to eccentric survivalists, as it does to conventional monasteries. Experience suggests that the wickedness of the world cannot be driven out simply by erecting high gates. One of the manifest failings of the Catholic hierarchy, as exposed by the Grand Juror's report, lay precisely in its introversion. This was an environment where bishops never expected their action or inaction to be exposed to the daylight of scrutiny by fair-minded, fair third parties from the wider world. But withdrawal in a spirit of honest repentance is different from withdrawal in a spirit of arrogant disapproval, even though the two things can easily become confused. Now, at least, Mr. Dreher seems to understand that point clearly, and the abuse scandal has sharpened his understanding. And back to the religious news service now of August 24th. A Buddhist nun shares the art of eating mindfully. Thubten Damcho stood before a half dozen garden beds bursting with leafy vegetables and thought back to her life before becoming a Buddhist nun, when she was so busy as a Singapore professional that she rarely took time to eat well. Damcho would eat between meetings, she said, or late in the evenings to socialize and network. Besides ramen noodles, she didn't really know how to cook. Now, though, she's cooking for a whole community. She regularly helps prepare simple, healthy, vegetarian meals for about 30 people at Srivasti Abbey, a Tibetan Buddhist monastery located about an hour north of Spokane, Washington. Damcho credits her abbess, Thubten Chodron, with transforming both her way of eating and of living. Chodron, who founded Srivasti Abbey 15 years ago, brings food into many of the values lessons she teaches to the 16 full-time residents of the abbey. She compiled these insights into her forthcoming book, The Compassionate Kitchen, Buddhist Practices for Eating with Mindfulness and Gratitude, offering advice on using mealtimes to develop compassion and gratefulness. It comes out in December from Shambhala Publications. According to Buddhism, all earthly struggles stem from attachment, and food is no exception. Chodron is careful to explain, however, that there's nothing wrong with enjoying eating. Enjoyment is a feeling of pleasure, said Chodron. Attachment is that you're just not content with enjoying it. You want more, you want better. So there's craving, there's grasping, there's clinging, and that is what brings difficulty. In her book, she teaches the five contemplations, which are aimed at fostering mindful eating. They're short verses designed to inspire reflections on the kindness of those who have made the meal possible, how a meal and the preparation that goes into it can help improve one's practice, guard the mind from thoughts that lead to wrongdoing, see food as medicine, and seek enlightenment. Christian Wedemeyer, associate professor of the History of Religions at the University of Chicago, said vegetarianism plays an essential role in most Buddhist traditions, though that wasn't always the case. He explained that in the 5th century BCE, when the Buddha lived, monastics would eat whatever lay people offered, even if it was meat that wasn't intentionally killed for them. At a certain point, he said, Buddhist thought evolved. It seemed having compassion for all beings and not eating them began to come to the fore, so that any consumption of meat violated their practice to benefit all beings. Lunch is the main meal at Srivasti, honoring a custom that dates to the Buddha's time. The 15 nuns and the one monk who live there take turns preparing food for the residents and about 15 guests on average. Many guests are Buddhists, others are curious to learn about the tradition. Before the meal, a Dharma talk, or public teaching from a Buddhist leader, is given. Chodron explains in the book that it's a Buddhist tradition to offer a teaching in exchange for the meal. During a recent Exploring Monastic Life retreat, two nuns, Thubten Semtke and Tenzin Tsepel, were on kitchen duty. On the menu was rice, quinoa, tofu skins, stir-fry, cannellini beans, salad, guacamole, and peach cobbler with ice cream. Before they began preparing the food, they chanted, "How fortunate we are to have the opportunity to prepare and cook this food. The food will nourish their bodies, and the love we put into preparing it will nourish their hearts." Chants, many of which are included in Chonzon's book, are recited before and after meals, when receiving and offering food, and when working. Chodron also published a chant for grocery shopping, for readers who gather their food this way. The monastics only eat what they grow themselves or what is offered to them. The chants also remind the cooks that the food they're preparing was made available only through the kindness of others. A small group of volunteers regularly sends or brings boxes of food to the abbey, careful to include only ingredients that follow their diet. No meat, no onions, leeks, garlic, or radishes, vegetables that are believed to excite the senses. Although sweets sometimes make it into the kitchen, the goal is to eat healthily. We're not cooking to please anyone. It's not about applause. It's how we show love. We offer it and hope they feel nourished. Sarah Conover, a Spokane author, donates food to the Abbey and regularly volunteers to cook for guests and residents. "I'd love to cook for big crowds and love to treat them to something special." Conover's son is a Buddhist monk in Thailand, so she knows firsthand how appreciative the Abbey's residents are when offered a meal. Whittemeyer explained that more lay people, like Conover, are incorporating Buddhist principles into their daily lives. Food is medicine. Don't get too caught up in preferences or you're turned into a foodie in the bardo, the Buddhist teaching the state of stay between death and rebirth, and never get out. Most of all, beyond anything, is what I now say the five contemplations before the meal. Learning to engage food with respect is a way of shaping the heart, Chodron said. We need to learn to accept that whatever appears on the table is what you eat, and to get over a mind that complains. Well, that's all the time we have now for Religion in the News. Generously underwritten again by White Memorial Presbyterian Church. They can be reached at 919-834-3424. This has been Michael Blakely. I'll talk to you later.